from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, Paul Kalanithi received a terminal cancer diagnosis at the age of 36. The Stanford neurosurgeon decided to turn to writing to make sense of what would end up being the final 22 months of his life. His writing is now a book titled When Breath Becomes Air, and it was a finalist last month for the Pulitzer Prize. Kalanithi's wife, Lucy Kalanithi, joins us to talk about the central question her husband wrestled with: what makes life meaningful even in the face of death and decay? Join us next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, you're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Joining us in studio for the hour is Lucy Kalanithi, widow of Paul Kalanithi, a Stanford neurosurgeon who died of lung cancer in March of 2015 at the age of 37. One of his dying wishes was that his memoir, which he began writing after his terminal cancer diagnosis, be published. Lucy Kalanithi fulfilled that wish in his book titled When Breath Becomes Air, was a finalist for this year's Pulitzer Prize. Lucy Kalanithi joins us to talk about how her husband, who'd counseled so many facing death, approached his own, their decision to have a child after his cancer diagnosis, and her own experience of loving and losing Paul Kalanithi. Lucy Kalanithi, welcome to Forum.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. Paul Kalanithi lived to see the manuscript of his memoir get sold to Random House. That was...
Yes, that's exactly right.
But he never actually saw the book.
Right, right. He wrote it in the last 11 months or so of his life, got the book deal, was totally thrilled. And then when he died, it was still like a Word document on his computer.
How did you choose the photo that you put in the book? There's only one, maybe two photos of him in the entire book, and I imagine there must have been some process you went through to think about which one you really wanted to put in there.
Yeah, there's an author photo on the back of the book, and it's a picture of Paul as a physician. So he's wearing a white coat, and I think he might even have a surgical cap on. And, you know, he was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer at 36 as a chief resident in neurosurgery at Stanford. So he ended up sort of with these two really distinct identities of both physician and patient. But having him, in, you know, pictured as a physician, it was such an important part of who he was, and that felt right.
Could I ask you to read from the book about the moment when he is making that transition from physician to patient, which is a big part of what he grapples with in this particular book?
Sure. Oh, it was such an intense moment. So this describes what that felt like for him. I received the plastic arm bracelet all patients wear, put on the familiar light blue hospital gown, walked past the nurses I knew by name, and was checked into a room, the same room where I had seen hundreds of patients over the years. In this room, I had sat with patients and explained terminal diagnoses and complex operations. In this room, I had congratulated patients on being cured of a disease. In this room, I had pronounced patients dead. I had sat in the chairs, washed my hands in the sink, scrawled instructions on the marker board, changed the calendar. I had even, in moments of utter exhaustion, longed to lie down in this bed and sleep. Now I lay there, wide awake. A young nurse, one I hadn't met, poked her head in. "The doctor will be in soon." And with that, the future I had imagined, the one just about to be realized, the culmination of decades of striving, evaporated.
And that's Lucy Kalanithi reading from the book When Breath Becomes Air by her late husband, Paul Kalanithi. How would you describe how he worked through that transition of caregiver to patient?
Yeah, it was so interesting, Mina, because, you know, he's 36 and he got this terminal diagnosis. He had incurable lung cancer. But one thing that was so striking to me was, you know, there's the pain of facing your mortality and limited time. And then there was this whole other type of pain we hadn't even realized as physicians, which was the total upheaval in your identity. So Paul talks at the end of that passage about my future evaporated, and it's sort of realize how much of your identity is tied up in your future self and who you're striving to be. And it's like you have a child who's growing up, or you're doing your training, your work. And so to have all of that future evaporate, it was incredibly disorienting. So, and then obviously, given the uncertainty about how much time he had left, sort of figuring out who he was and what was important, how to spend that time, was so challenging.
Yes, that time question really seemed to gnaw at him quite a bit. He wrote about how he was both living and dying at the same time. There were some moments in this book where he says, was I living or dying? Even if I'm dying, until I actually die, I'm still living. And he also says, the curse of cancer created a strange and strained existence, challenging me to be neither blind to nor bound by death's approach. And I found this very interesting that initially, when he first got the diagnosis, he was prepared for death. And then there was a time when he started to get better. The drugs were working initially. They were reducing the tumors. And then he fell into a bit of a depression because it left a much bigger question about how long. Can you talk about that struggle?
Yeah, and he sort of made this joke that Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's, stages of grief going through a terminal diagnosis. He's like, I did those in reverse. I started with acceptance and then I worked backwards through, depression and other stages. I think the tricky part about that was the uncertainty around how much time he had left, just made it really hard to decide what to do. And I think the biggest initial decision was whether to return to work as a neurosurgeon without the certainty of decades of being able to do it, but also, knowing how meaningful it was to him. And that there was sort of a physical impossibility, too. I think initially he did need to wait for those drugs to start working before he was even strong enough. And then he decided he wanted to do it.
And also this question of what do you do with the time that you have? But then it's very different if you have a very short period of time versus if you have a very long period of time. And do you want to spend that time doing the work, not really knowing how
totally
long? And it was interesting. His physician really brought it to the level of values, I guess, to help him sort that out.
Right. I mean, she asked him, she sort of implored him every time they met. She said, what's most important to you now? How can I be helping you reach that? And that was everything from tailoring his chemo so that he wouldn't get neuropathy in his fingers, he could still be a surgeon, to once he was writing the manuscript for When Breath Becomes Air, putting him on a stimulant medication so he could focus. I mean, she really paid attention to what mattered to him. It was amazing.
You mentioned his sense of humor, too, just a moment ago. And I was curious whether or not there was room for his humor. There's not that much of it in the book, I guess. So whether there was room for it during, what he was going through.
It's so funny because one of the things that's most heartbreaking to our friends is that the book's not funny. I mean, really, truly, Paul was like one of the funniest people any of us knew. He chose not to be super funny in the book. There's little hints. But he was, it's a serious book about mortality and meaning. So I'm okay with it. He was joking a lot of the time. I'm trying to even think of an example. From the time that he was sick, I can't think of a specific one, but he just was, there's this funny thing about him where he used to keep a gorilla suit in the trunk of his car and he'd say, it's for emergencies only. I mean, he wore a fake mustache in his med school ID, partly as an amulet. He was worried, medicine would strip him of something of his humanity, So he was really funny. He used to be a comedy writer at Stanford. He wrote for the Stanford Band. He was kind of a nut.
And the two of you met at Yale in medical
That's
school.
Right.
What was it like for you through this process? So you are with him when he's going through this transition of caregiver to patient, when he gets this diagnosis, and you yourself are a caregiver who witnessed people dying. I'm curious how taking care of him reshaped your identity.
Yeah. And sort of backing up a little bit, I mean, I kind of feel like Paul and I grew up together. Medical school is such a crucible because you're learning to witness suffering, you're working really hard, and we were in the same class and did all that together. And I was really grateful because we sort of had a language around sort of what it means to have a mortal body and how to approach suffering in a way that I think we wouldn't have had we not been two physicians necessarily. And then I sort of, I think I've said witnessing suffering a bunch of times, but I feel like as a caregiver, as Paul's wife when he was sick, there was so much that I couldn't fix. You know, I couldn't cure the illness. Sometimes I couldn't take away his physical pain, which was so difficult for me. But I sort of saw some of my role as being a witness, you know, like being present to, present for what was happening with him and sort of entering into that pain with him. So, I mean, that sort of shaped what I felt like I was doing.
We're talking with Lucy Kalanithi, wife of the late Paul Kalanithi, a Stanford neurosurgeon who died of terminal lung cancer in March of 2015. He wrote, "When Breath Becomes Air in the Last 22 Months of His Life," it explores mortality, and he asks the question in the book, what makes life meaningful in the face of death and decay? Lucy Kalanithi is a clinical assistant professor of medicine at Stanford University School of Medicine. I'd like to invite our listeners to join the conversation. The number is 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. If you or a loved one have received a terminal prognosis, how did it change the way you live? What has seen you through in the face of great suffering, as Lucy Kalanithi brings up? Or what makes essentially life worth living? You can email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org, post them on our website, kqed.org/forum, or on Facebook or Twitter. We're at KQED Forum. That last question is a big question, what makes life worth living? But part of the reason that I even put that out to our listeners is because it felt like the central question through Paul's book. Even before he was diagnosed with cancer, he was asking himself, what makes life meaningful?
Yeah, one of Paul's friends said this really beautiful thing after Paul died. He said, you know, I think Paul felt the struggle to find meaning is the meaning, which I kind of loved. And I'm always a little bit petrified that someone's going to ask me, you know, what's the meaning of life, given that my husband wrote this memoir. So maybe the callers can help us.
But is that satisfying? Was that satisfying to him? If that was near the conclusion that he drew, your friend's notion that the meaning of life is in searching for the meaning, essentially?
I mean, kind of. This is a time where I really wish he were here to answer that. I think, you know, he writes about in the book the importance to him of striving. And initially as a physician, you know, where he's talking about striving to be able to care for your patients. But then, you know, we wrestled with the decision to have a child. I don't know. I think he was sort of stretching his idea about, you know, accepting the joy and pain that comes in life, and then sort of expanding his idea about what it meant to strive. So maybe.
And talk about your decision to have a child together. When did you make this decision, and how did you make this decision?
So Paul and I were in our mid-30s when he was diagnosed. I'm an internist. He was finishing his training as a neurosurgeon. And we'd always thought we would have children right around that time. You know, like Paul's going to finish residency and things are going to get easier. And then he was diagnosed with terminal cancer. But we kind of, you know, revisited that conversation, both knowing it was a little bit insane to have a child maybe. But we had the instinct to do it. You know, we had a lot of support from our families and talked about it a lot. And then there was this one sort of crystallizing conversation where I was really worried about his experience. And I said, you know, don't you think if we decide to have a child, saying goodbye to the child is going to make dying more painful for you? And he said this really beautiful thing. He said, wouldn't it be great if it did? Sort of thinking about not so much avoiding suffering, but inviting this whole range of experience into your life with having a child. And I read Andrew Solomon's book, Far From the Tree, around that time, which is so amazing about families in which a child is born and it creates a certain type of hardship in the family for whatever reason. And all the parents, I mean, almost to a person, say, this didn't make my life easier, but it made it richer and it made me sort of a deeper person and more resilient. And I've sort of related to that. I mean, I was having that experience during Paul's illness too. So I think it sort of reshaped for me what it means. You know, there's a difference between happiness and meaning, but I think those meaningful things are what really make our lives fulfilling.
And And just talk about why it was such this super enlightening moment for you. I mean, you've touched on it a little bit about how it that life means sort of inviting the full range of experiences. But prior to that, how had you been seeing it?
I mean, I guess I sort of flipped back and forth. But I did, around that decision about having a child, think, you know, this is going to bring uncertainty. This is going to bring real joy and real sadness. And I think I had the instinct to spare, in a way, to spare Paul the intensity of having a child while knowing he was dying. You know, I just knew that was so painful. But for him to sort of invite that very willingly just suddenly made me feel like it was okay.
Does that affect the way you work as a physician now, understanding those twin things when you talk to people or have to give people a difficult news?
Yeah, somewhat. I mean, it's sort of a...
I mean, I don't know in your role
changes,
how much you...
It changes the language I use a little bit. And even in my own life, you know, I think I used to sort of use like more... This is just one thing that pops into my head. I sort of used to use more judgmental words. You know, I'd think in my mind, like, this is terrible. This is a nightmare. And now I think things more like, this is very painful, you know. But there's not that added layer of kind of judgment around something. And I think when I'm talking to other people, either about my experience or about something that's happening to them, I think there's a different tenor of the words I use. That's an example.
Well, we have some listeners calling in. Let's hear from Anthony in Concord. Hi, Anthony.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, and Lucy, to you, and, you know, appreciate you taking the time to share this, because I feel that, you know, not enough people, you know, share their stories. And, you know, my father passed away 3 years ago at age 50 of stage 4 pancreatic cancer. July 27th, he turned 50. July 31st, he was diagnosed. And I remember walking up to him in the shed, and I asked him, like, you know, he looked really down. I was like, Dad, what's going on? And, you know, he was like, I'll wait till Mom gets home, because my mom was traveling. But, you know, I pressed him, and I remember him saying, you know, I got so much that I still want to do that I need to do. And 12 weeks later, he died. You know, he went through the chemo, everything. Doctors said he would, you know, have 18 more months if he started. You know, but unlike the doctor that your husband had, my doctor for my dad just pretty much asked him all of his, you know, what's going on. And she was like, okay, and just kept pushing meds on him. And it just kept killing him. You know, we have a for-profit healthcare system that doesn't value the quality of life, that doesn't value giving someone comfort when it comes to mortality and the end of life. And the only thing that helped my father, and not to make it too political, was cannabis. And that made him see, you know, that he could enjoy a meal, you know, that he could put something down instead of just vomiting it back up, and that he could, you know, sit outside and enjoy it and go to the beach and enjoy that time versus, you know, sitting there in pain, which the doctors weren't acknowledging that and helping him reduce that, you know. And I feel that your story is so powerful, and thank you for sharing that. And to your husband, and I, you know, I hope that, you know, your child can, you know, keep him living on.
Anthony, thank you for that. And I'm sorry for what you experienced, you know, especially initially with the doctors. Lucy, you gave a TED Talk recently where you actually addressed some of these issues in terms of end of life and advanced care directives and quality of life. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. Anthony, I'm so sorry for your loss. I think about what you said a lot in healthcare and sort of the predominant battle metaphor that we tend to subscribe to, especially in cancer. You know, we're going to fight it. We're going to beat it. And I think there is that real tension where, like, what does the fight mean? And thinking about weighing quality and quantity of life. And, you know, kind of to your point, there've been some studies that show, you know, 1 in 4 people say that they or a family member have received excessive or unwanted medical care. And I think on the flip side, there's some real moral distress in medicine. Like, half of critical care nurses and 1/4 of ICU doctors have considered switching out of the field because of feeling like they're prolonging suffering or they're prolonging dying rather than enabling living. And so I think the taboos that are out there in society follow you into the hospital, and there's a lot of lack of clarity about what's most important. And I think that's something that's happening in a lot of families, and you know, I think those conversations can really help. It sounds like such a tough situation for your family.
I was struck by how, Lucy, you have talked about, Lucy Clonathy, the paperwork of doing an advance directive became almost part of your love story.
Yeah. I mean, that's a framing that occurred to me after Paul died. But, you know, there's the idea of advanced care planning, which is advance directives about what care you would want and then assigning a decision maker, a durable power of attorney. And those are like really boring pieces of paperwork in a way. But I sort of came to think of them more like a wedding vow, like they're a commitment to somebody to represent them and even to speak for them. And there's some real data that if you have an advance directive and you've done advanced care planning, you're more likely to get care that makes sense to you, and you're more likely to be more satisfied with your care, and there's less trauma in families or even depression or PTSD in survivors. So I think the idea of that sort of becoming a norm in society is a really important one.
I think you've also said something or alluded to something very beautiful about being part of marriage where you become the person who speaks for your loved one when they can no longer speak for themselves. Renee writes, what role do you think you and Paul being physicians played in understanding Paul's diagnosis as terminal? So often today when people receive the diagnosis of a very serious illness, the knowledge of a terminal prognosis does not come until much later. Doctors are often scared to be straightforward with patients, and I worry that people are being robbed of knowledge for informed decisions.
Yeah, I mean, there's a study that found that over half of doctors have said that at some point they painted a rosier picture for a patient than they really believed. And I think that's certainly comes out of kindness, right? And even love for your patients, this idea of sort of protecting people. But at least in our family, I mean, that decision to have a baby really required this real knowledge about what we were facing, especially for me, you know, knowing I'd be a solo parent. And I think oftentimes it can be so painful and anxiety provoking, but it does give you a better chance to plan, and it often reduces trauma down the line in families. So I think there's a lot of support for physicians now, you know, Vital Talk and Atul Gawande's Serious Illness mm-hmm. Conversation Guide. And I think the culture is changing in medicine.
How so?
I mean, just with sort of that comment about are you helping your patient? Are you depriving your patient? And what words can you use? I mean, I think medical schools are really starting to teach these honest conversations that are kind of both honest and supportive.
We're talking with Lucy Clonathy, widow of Paul Clonathy, a Stanford neurosurgeon who died of terminal lung cancer a couple of years ago. He wrote, when breath becomes air in the last 22 months of his life. And Lucy Clonathy is a clinical assistant professor of medicine at Stanford University School of Medicine. She wrote the epilogue to the book, which became a finalist for this year's Pulitzer Prize. We'll have more with her after the break and with you. Give us a call at 866-733-6786 if you'd like to join the conversation. Again, 866-733-6786. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, on our website, or email us, forum@kqed.org. I'm Mina Kim. Stay with us. You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking with Lucy Clonathy, clinical assistant professor of medicine at the Stanford University School of Medicine. She's the widow of Paul Clonathy, author of When Breath Becomes Air, a memoir that he wrote in his final 22 months of life that has been that is a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. And we're joined by you, our listeners, and you can join us at 866-733-6786. You can also post your comments on our website, kqed.org/forum, email us or post your comments on Facebook or Twitter. We're getting a lot of them right now, and I want to go to Puneet in San Francisco.
Hi, Lucy. Thank you for making the time today, and thanks to you and Paul for sharing your story. Certainly helped me, and I'm sure people all over the world. Lucy, I wanted to ask you personally, from your own perspective, what sort of steps did you take during Paul's treatment, et cetera, and after as well, after his passing, and sort of what did you do for yourself in order to gain the strength that you needed? And what are some of the things that you continue to do, and how, you know, what have you learned about yourself during this time?
Yeah. It's funny. Thank you so much for what you said. I think, you know, the moment of diagnosis was this huge moment of upheaval for Paul in his identity. And for me, that came after Paul died, which maybe seems sort of obvious. I think I wasn't even prepared for how much, how upending that would be. For me, I sort of came back to really nuts and bolts coping strategies that I would even tell a patient. You know, they're not rocket science, but they really helped save me, including from postpartum depression when we had Katie. And that was stuff like mindfulness meditation and exercise and making sure I slept and making sure I, you know, stayed socially connected. And then I found reading really helpful too. I read a lot of poetry actually after Paul died. There's some really beautiful poems about, you know, incorporating joy and pain together. There's one called A Brief for the Defense by Jack Gilbert. And I love some poems about grief, like Elegy for Philip Sidney by Greville, who's the Elizabethan poet Paul adapted his book title from. I found poems kind of digestible, but really crystallizing and beautiful.
You've said in an interview that you were stunned by how much you were still so in love with him, even though you couldn't be next to him physically.
Yeah.
That really surprised you in terms of your own.
Yeah. Can I read a little bit about that?
Yes, please.
There's this essay that I wrote in the New York Times called My Marriage Didn't End When I Became a Widow, and it talks about another thing I read, actually. I was writing about this night after Paul died, and I said, one night recently, alone in bed, I read A Grief Observed by C.S. Lewis, and I came across the observation that bereavement is not the truncation of married love, but one of its regular phases. And it's talking about that idea where bereavement isn't just separating from your spouse, but instead, he says, what we want is to live our marriage well and faithfully through that phase too. And I've found that in addition to the pain and sadness and anxiety that came with losing Paul, my love for him is exactly the same. And my sort of feeling of devotion to him and working on the book and, you know, putting When Breath Becomes Air out in the world has felt like completing something for him in a way that's felt deep and important to me as his wife. You know what I mean?
Even before that passage in the essay, you describe going to his grave and lying on top of it in running your hands through the grass as if it were like Paul's hair, this sense of intimacy and closeness that you had that you still felt so strongly after his death.
Yeah, I couldn't sleep during those weeks. And then I went to his grave and like sort of lay on top of the grave and fell into this deep sleep. And it was like sort of like the closest I could get to Paul. It was so intense.
You've talked about how being able to talk about this book, publish this book, finish it, has been a process, has been part of the process for you, the journey that you've taken of being true and faithful to him. I wonder, though, what it is like to have to keep talking about it, to be invited to keep reliving some of the most heart-wrenching moments of your life. Are there downsides?
I mean, there's one sort of liability. I think overall it's been really great. Writing helped Paul cope, and I'm a talker. So it's like he was made to write a book and I was made to do a book tour. And I think talking about him has made me feel connected and less lonely. And the book is a way for people to connect with me instead of like treating me with kid gloves or being nervous to ask me. I think the one thing, you know, the book came out in January 2016. So over a year ago, and I've been talking about it since. And I've sort of forced myself to like be honest about what's happening in my own life since. You know, it's like I sort of don't want to tell the same story over and over because I'm not even the same person, you know. So initially I was only talking about Paul in the book, and then I had a chance to talk about grief, and then I've been talking about healthcare value. And, you know, I mean, it's like I got interviewed by the London Telegraph like a month ago, and they asked me if I was thinking about dating, and I said, yeah. And it's like, you know, I mean, that wasn't true initially, but it's true now. And so I'm sort of like, oh, can I say that? And it's like, yeah, sure. I mean, that's true. You know, so I've just tried to myself be straightforward as I move through this.
And you've talked about how, too, right after Paul's diagnosis, he very immediately said to you, I want you to remarry.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. That was so intense and heartbreaking. But amazing, right? I mean, he was expressing a real devotion to me, even as he said that, you know, I mean, he's acknowledging what's actually happening. And then I thought it was so generous and freeing, you know, I mean, it was,
but in the moment, it must have been.
Can you imagine saying that to your spouse? It's just like, it was amazing.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Puneet, for the question. And let's hear from Scott in San Francisco. Hi, Scott.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to echo what many of the other previous callers have said. And Lucy, thank you so much for the grace with which you have this conversation. Hearing especially what you had mentioned about the potential for adding pain to your husband's death with the prospect of having a child, it reminded me of really the only time that I've experienced this kind of tragedy in my brief existence on this here planet Earth, when my childhood dog, you know, came down with basically sickness that resulted in us having to put him down, and being able to spend the last few days with my dog in that situation and just enduring a more full spectrum of the human experience, I think, was just rewarding. And it's just really, really wonderful to hear a perspective as fresh and as honest and as truthful as yours on a matter such as this. So I just wanted to thank you for that.
Thank you so much, Scott.
Thank you, Scott. Laura writes, I don't know what this means in terms of what gives life meaning, but I always tell my 93-year-old father as far in advance as possible when I'm coming to visit him, not so he can prepare, but so he can enjoy looking forward to it. I wonder if that is one of the things that gives life meaning, looking forward to something pleasant.
That's so awesome. There's some study about the anticipation of a vacation is as good or better than the vacation. Although I'm sure when you visit your dad, it's amazing.
Aaron writes, it's in books like When Breath Becomes Air that I find a quiet, private space in the busy world. I can reflect and wonder and cry and feel my humanity. Literature helps us travel emotionally, and that is deeply meaningful. Paul Glonathy chose the title, correct?
Right.
He was able to do that, and it's from a poem.
It's from a poem. It's by Greville, that Elizabethan statesman and poet. And it starts, it's the epigraph to the book, and it's this little pithy poem about life and death, and it says, you that seek what life is in death, now find it air that once was breath. So the title, When Breath Becomes Air, is describing the moment of dying where, you know, what was breath is now air.
Mm. And in so many ways, too, the own question that he centered his life around. You've said that just before the interview started, when I congratulated you on the Pulitzer Prize finalist, and that acknowledgement, and you said, oh, that's one of the moments where I so wish he was here. What are those moments when you say that hit you the most, that is a moment that I wish he was here for?
Yeah. Mostly they're centered around the book and what's happened since Paul's book came out. And then obviously lots and lots of things related to our daughter. I mean, those are the two legacies that he ended up leaving. And so to see those two things grow, especially funny things she says or her, you know, it's those two things.
What do you tell Katie about him?
So
for
the first time, she sort of asked about him in the past few months. She can recognize him in a photo, which makes me really happy, but it's also kind of a party trick. You know, I mean, for her to point him out, I say, what's your daddy's name? And she says, Paul. But I talk about him, and I am working on this little book for her because she's really aware of all these characters, right? Like, she knows all about Elmo. She knows all about Mickey and Minnie. And so for her to be able to read a simple book about him with pictures and a story, and she's part of that story, I mean, I think I just want to have help her get a sense of him that's sort of age appropriate. I mean, she's about to turn 3, so she's really little. But I think she's going to grow up hearing about him in all these conversations from his parents, brothers, me. So I have to figure out where she's going to put that in her mind. And it does feel like a real challenge to help her understand where she came from. And my main thing is that I want her to feel like it's okay to ask.
Lillian writes, bless his wife and child. Paul's book has so made me appreciate life, living, and family. Let's hear from Katrina in San Jose. Hi, Katrina.
Hey, hi there. I love the book, and it's a really fruitful conversation today. Thank you so much. I'm a nurse. I've been a nurse in this area for 15 years. And I did training, multiple trainings, as did most of my colleagues, on advanced care planning, palliative care. And I really am disappointed. I would think that 10 years later, 15 years later, we'd be so much farther ahead. I work in a hospital in San Jose, and we don't even have a palliative care policy, really. We don't have a palliative care team. We don't have a cohesive culture that embraces dynamic end-of-life care or complicated, you know, conversations. And I see physicians and, of course, nurses all struggling with this. And it's disappointing, you know. It really is. We should be better at this. We deserve better as a culture, and our patients deserve better.
Katrina, thanks. Palliative care, that's something that, you know, matters a lot to you.
Yeah. Lucy. Thank you for the chance to plug palliative care. I totally agree with you. And I think there's a lot of misconceptions about what that is, right? So palliative care is a medical specialty that grew up to meet a particular need. And they are specialty teams that include doctors, nurses, chaplains, and they're focused on maximizing quality of life through things like symptom control and also helping with complicated medical decision making, especially when there's a tension between quality and quantity of life. And, you know, there's this sort of misconception where hospice, which is for people who have a terminal diagnosis, less than 6 months to live, is a tiny little subset of palliative care. So anybody with a serious illness, whether or not you're dying anytime soon, can do palliative care. And that's, you know, cancer, HIV, emphysema, Parkinson's, you know. And I think there's a website called getpalliativecare.org that can help people find it. But it's so amazing. And there's a few studies that are coming out that show in some situations, and advanced lung cancer is one of them, palliative care may actually prolong life, even at the same time as the medical care people are getting may not be so intensive. So trading risks and benefits is really important to think about. Palliative care is spectacular.
And let me thank Katrina for the call. Phyllis writes, a few months before my mother died, she looked at me and said, I know what you are feeling about my dying. I had those feelings when I knew that my mother might die. I always believed and still do that I missed her while she was alive. Now my husband has not talked to his sons about his having lymphoma, and this creates a distance between them. Mm-hmm. Charles writes, I'm going through this with my mom right now. The grieving is over, resignation has set in, and the waiting hurts all of us. And let's hear from Bob in Campbell. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Mina. And thanks, Lucy, for being on. I have buried a wife and a fiance over the years, so I know what you're going through. And I've also died a few times myself and been revived. I now have a defibrillator in my chest as a result. But what I discovered is that besides the fact that cancer sucks, is that, as you well know, helping others has really helped me get through it. I became a fitness instructor in spite of the heart issue. And I've discovered that group exercise, just the social aspect of it, and trying to help people feel good about themselves in a society with all of the body image issues that we have, and just making it okay to be yourself. And it's sort of my version of the old saying, God heals and the doctor takes the credit. I can't make people stronger, but I can help them find their strength.
I want to read your book,
and
Bob.
So, haven't written it yet, but I hope to meet you someday. I also went to Stanford and was treated there. So It's a good place.
Go hard.
Well, Bob, thank you. The moment when Paul Klonathy said, I'm ready. He was in a hospital bed. You were surrounded by family. He didn't want a ventilator. The most important thing for him was to hold Katie. How did you feel when he told you he was ready?
Oh, that day was so intense. So that was the morning of March 9th, 2015, when Paul died. And I think being a physician, he had seen, you know, the trade-offs that come with going on intensive life support, you know, specifically a ventilator, a breathing machine, and realized that if his time was limited, he wanted to stay mentally lucid and have our daughter Katie in the room with him. And that was at Stanford. And I think he made a choice that fit him, you know, and I think I just can't overstate how sad and painful it was. I think I'll never see the sentence, you know, he died peacefully surrounded by his family of cancer. I think, you know, even though it made sense and it was beautiful, it just was so sad, but I really supported that decision.
You talked about also not being able to leave him in the hospital bed.
Yeah, I could barely move my legs to walk away. And I was sort of making this weird noise, and I knew it. I later learned that the word is keening, sort of like this grief noise. And my sister-in-law was sort of holding my elbow, and she had to say over and over, she was like, he's not here. He's not here. It's okay to leave. I'd just been so devoted to him. And so it almost felt like he just died. He's like, he needs us. And it was so hard for me to leave his body. I felt like I was walking away at a time that he needed us. It didn't make any sense, but you know, that's how I felt.
Yeah. Well, let's hear from Kayla in Sacramento. Hi, Kayla.
Hi. Thank you, Lucy. You're doing a great job, and your dedication to your husband is coming out in so many important dimensions. I just wanted to share quickly my own story and then kind of echo what the previous callers have said. My own story is I'm a physician. My father was a very cognitively driven scientist who had two terminal illnesses. One was a rapidly progressive. The other was a slow neuromuscular. So the quality of life issue was very, very hard to. I went through some process first cognitively, then emotionally, and I realized that he was not prepared for death because of his cognitive thinking, and that the emotional aspect was forced on him. Me, on the other hand, had a bit of a balance being in the healthcare field, but I too struggled with it in a way that I'd never struggled with it in patient care. It is very up close personal, and it is very different as you have gone through it. But having said that, I wanted to just touch upon many issues that, as the previous caller said, are yet poorly being addressed. And I commend the work of the role of palliative care. But there are three aspects that have poorly been addressed. The first thing is the social aspect, and that is the social-emotional aspect of what the patient wants and what the family wants and the dynamics that come into play. The second aspect is the medical field, which many people have touched upon. It is too much, and the palliative care comes in the equation too late, by which time we have probably reduced quality of life and created maybe several other problems. And the last thing is the legal. I have been approached by many friends who are going through situations like this with their families, and they don't know where to go, meaning each state has its own set of rules and regulations. We have a patchwork of the healthcare system and a legal system. There really needs to be a uniform national advanced care directive, and there needs to be a lot more patient information and education put forth. I'm going to leave you with that, and I know you're doing fantastic work, but we all feel like a lot more needs to be done, and I think you will carry that torch very forward.
Kayla, thank you. Thank you very much.
There's two advanced care planning documents I really like. One is called Respecting Choices, which Gunderson Health uses and Kaiser Northern California is using. And there's another one called Five Wishes that anybody can get. I really like those.
Well, Steve writes, my wife passed away 4 months ago after 3 years of battling ovarian cancer. We were married for 34 years. My feeling about my wife's passing is evolving. I know that she saw her passing as a way to give me a new life. I find myself doing all the things that she wanted me to do but would never do. It's no longer a chore or a task. It's a joy. I know that it's her giving me a continuous gift. I exercise. I eat properly. I made my body something that I cherish. Every night I go to sleep astounded by the miracle that I'm alive. I have a physical body that I can feel everything with, which is attached to a mind that can contemplate that to a level of understanding that can manifest grace.
It's beautiful.
One of the things that it's interesting because I watched some of your early interviews and actually read a couple of the ones that you gave later on. And one of the things that struck me, you've also done a recent TED Talk, I guess courage is the word that comes to mind, but it seemed like over time with your relationship laid bare in Paul's book, during the time that he was dying and through this process of seeing and understanding life and death and the balance that we live in, it's almost as if sort of the pettiness of life or the insecurities of life no longer affect you. Is that an accurate description of one of the ways you've changed from this experience?
I think I'm better able to tolerate pain for the reasons you described. But I don't know. I was in an airport yesterday and I was kind of petty, just like everybody is in the airport. So not necessarily, not every day.
Well, Mari writes, there's a song in Spanish by Luis Eduardo Aute that is profound about grief and loss. It's called Sin Tu Latido, Without Your Heartbeat. Some of the lyrics say, I sleep with your name kissing my mouth. I recommend it to anyone going through this loss.
Oh, wow.
And let's hear from Daniel at Stinson Beach. Hi, Daniel.
Hi there. Recently, last year, I was diagnosed with a brain tumor. And the anxiety and fear was just extraordinary. And fortunately, in my case, it was not malignant, so I didn't die or didn't go through that process. But I did begin to consider, how did I want to die? And I did realize that I wanted to die with the highest quality possible. So I began to develop what I called qualities of energy. And these qualities of energy began with just three of them initially. It was gratitude. And of course, gratitude was not only being appreciative for what I have and where I was, but the commitment to being present with those people that I was with. And gratitude given with grace meant that it was elegant. And as a result, it began to generate more generosity. So the qualities of life became, the light became better, my ease became better, and I realized that when I want to die, I want to die in the best quality and the best kind of shape I can possibly be in.
Well, Daniel, thank you for that comment. I want to try to get a couple more in here. Tina in Sacramento. Hi, Tina.
Hi. Oh, this, what a wonderful conversation, Lucy. Thank you so much. I'm just listening to all these comments, and I'm in awe of the conversation and echo what I think the nurse, palliative care nurse, said earlier. I started out as a healthcare lawyer in 1986, dealing with consent issues and writing policies about palliative care for the first time. And it feels like we're barely made any progress at all. And then we have a conversation like this. So thank you for generating it. What I wanted to ask you about was that moment after Paul died. The first time when my dad died, which was the first death, I wanted to go get my mother out of there. He was in an AIDS hospice in San Francisco. And a friend of mine said, you know, Tina, it's okay to sit with the body, to sit with him. And it just never would have occurred to me, never in a million years. And it turned out that my sister and I, who'd been his caregivers, sat with him for hours. And we did the same thing with my stepfather, and we did the same thing with my mom. The whole family was there. We washed her and oiled her and placed her out on her bed and hung out with her for the whole day. We called it Cinco de Mama. And so it's just this different ways of dealing with what happens after death. And I'm just curious about your thinking about that time space.
Thanks, Tina.
Oh, I love that. I mean, I think that's more probably consistent with what's been happening over across cultures and centuries. You know, I think that's there's a human instinct to do that. And it's really beautiful and brave and lovely.
Well, Kay asks, thank you for sharing this beautiful, heartbreaking story. What were your thoughts about how your child would feel knowing that she will not have a dad growing up? Did you and Paul discuss that?
You know, I don't think we discussed it. I can't remember a conversation about it, but I've thought about it a lot. And I think, you know, it's not the way I pictured my family would look. But I also think it's okay. I think she'll be okay. And part of that is she's really embedded in a huge, rich community. And that, I think, makes a real difference.
Well, Rachel writes, I was diagnosed with a rare heart condition 6 months after completing my residency. Your husband's story has been tremendously helpful for my entire family, including my four-year-old daughter, and we could not be more grateful that you've chosen to share this story with the world. Thank you for your brave honesty. I'm back to seeing patients currently, although only part-time. My interactions with my patients have been profoundly changed by my own illness, but also by Paul's book.
Wow.
Well, Lucy Glonathy, I want to thank you so much for coming in today. And I don't typically ask this, but are there any final thoughts that my questions or our listeners' questions or comments didn't get to that you really want to share?
I guess I can tell people about an event that's coming up. Is that okay?
Sure.
So on June 7th, I'm going to be at Book Passage in the Ferry Building at 6 p.m. And it's actually the launch for another memoir called The Bright Hour, which is beautiful, also written by a dying person. So maybe people could come and we can meet.
Lucy Klonathy, widow of Paul Klonathy, a Stanford neurosurgeon who died of terminal lung cancer and wrote When Breath Becomes Air in the last 22 months of his life. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Have a great weekend.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.